Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Peter. Peter is a 61-year-old family physician, also known as a general practitioner, in the United Kingdom. He has a conventional family and work life, but has been contemplating what he might do if our present comfortable way of life were to come to an end. He's therefore learning to grow some of his own food and is combining his interests in medicine, gardening, and history by reinventing plant-based anesthetics in the hope that one day the knowledge might be found to be useful to someone. Listeners are reminded that they should not try this at home, should not try this at home. His blog can be found at toxicplantsblog.blogspot.com. Toxicplantsblog.blogspot.com. That was plural on plants. So first off, thank you for doing this really interesting work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So let's let listeners know how this interview came about. I had done, I had put something out, an essay or a video or something, where I had mentioned that C.S. Lewis said that he thought that anesthetic, the most important modern invention. And you responded to that by writing me a note, hey, let's talk a little bit about prehistoric anesthetics or plant-based anesthetics. And I wrote back to you and said, that sounds delightful. I would love to know more about this. So would you rather start by talking about how you became interested in plant anesthetics, or B, start by talking about either the human or evolutionary history of plant?
Well, maybe I could just explain how I became interested in it. As you said in your intro, I'm a conventional family physician, but sometimes it concerns me that I can only practice my job as a doctor if I'm supported by a whole infrastructure of technology and hundreds, if not thousands, of other people working behind the scenes. So, for example, today I was at work and most of the day I sat at my computer typing into it and printing out prescriptions, writing referral letters and so on. But if you stop and think about it, it's an incredibly complicated system and it needs a lot of moving parts to make it work. So, for example, I need a continuous electric supply for the computer. I need an information technology team to keep the computer and its network running. I need spare supplies for the printer, like the ink cartridges, so I can print things out. When the patient takes the prescription to the pharmacist needs to have a supply chain from the chemical factory to the wholesaler, so that he's got stuff on the shelves. The wholesaler needs to have supplies of oil, if that's what the feedstock is, to make the pharmaceuticals. And if any one of those components of the system were to break down, everything would stop. So, for example, if there was a trade dispute with China, let's say, and I couldn't get my ink cartridges, I couldn't print out the prescriptions, so the patient couldn't take the prescription to the pharmacy and so on. So it set me thinking, how could I practice medicine if all that went away and I was just left with my own skill and my own hands and a few simple tools? So I decided to look into plant-based anesthetics, and I've accumulated quite a library of books on what you might call survival and austere medicine, things like that. So at my time of life, I'm hoping that I will never have to go to a remote farmhouse and deliver a baby in the farmhouse kitchen, but if I did have to, I would know how to do it. So that's really how and why I got interested in it.
So before we talk more about the plants, I want to bring up something that I just found very, very fascinating, having to do with exactly what you're talking about, that my interest in COVID really started. The point here is not COVID. The point is shutting down economic systems and global transportation. That my interest in COVID started when, I believe it was 2 or 3 days after they shut down Wuhan, a Hyundai factory in Korea had to shut down because they couldn't get parts from Wuhan. And it was literally 2 or 3 days. And that struck me as extraordinary, interconnectedness and fragility of a global economic and transportation system. And if you are reliant for your for some sort of necessary pain medicine on a global transportation system that could be interdicted by a pandemic or by a an earthquake, by a big storm, by a war. And what would happen if there was a war between? This has happened in the past, as I'm sure you'll discuss with Britain with the blockade in World War II. Anyway, so it's fascinating that you would think that things like food systems and also pain control systems would be, there would at least be attempts made to localize them.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. I think people living in society nowadays take an awful lot for granted. It's just taken for granted that the supermarket shelves will always be stocked with food, the pharmacy shelves will always be stocked with medicine. And I wonder how realistic that is. I mean, I live on a small island off the coast of Britain, and we've had supply shortages here, nothing major, but for example, there were shortages of various food items on the supermarket shelves simply because a lot of lorry drivers, truck drivers, were off sick with COVID, so the trucks weren't running, so the supermarkets weren't being supplied. Now, it was a temporary hiccup, but if that were to become a more permanent hiccup, that would be a big problem. I don't think there's really a plan B to get around that.
So let's talk, where would you like to start with the history of plant anesthetics? Would you like to start with human use, or would you like to start with evolution? And it's your call on how you want to go.
Well, if we do it logically, let's start with pre-human use. I mean, plants have developed defense mechanisms, and toxins are one of them. Some animals have done that as well. I think this is the plant's way of saying, I'm not good to eat, leave me alone, don't touch me. So, you know, if you eat a plant and you either die or you're paralyzed or you're rendered unconscious for a few days, you tend not to do it again. But humans are very ingenious, and we found ways of using those toxins in plants in small doses for beneficial purposes. So, for example, there are toxins in some plants like deadly nightshade and hemlock and monkshood, which cause paralysis. And if you eat enough of them, your breathing muscles will be paralyzed and you'll die within minutes. But if you just take a small amount, it can be sufficient to relax you for surgery. I've seen a patient undergo abdominal surgery who wasn't fully relaxed, and I'm not going to go into the gory details of it, but it really brought home to me how important it is for the patient to be relaxed in surgery. Other things like mandrake can induce drowsiness, opium poppies for pain relief, and those are the kind of things you want if you're about to undergo something unpleasant like an amputation, for example. So people from ancient times have known about these. They were known in ancient Sumeria 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, when they used a combination of opium and alcohol for simple surgical procedures, and many more anesthetic drugs were known to the Greeks and Romans. The knowledge of that was passed down countries that the Greeks and Romans conquered, and knowledge was passed on, for example, to people living in medieval Britain after the Romans departed. That's a brief history, really, of the first 3,000 or 4,000 years of anesthetics. What happened in medieval Europe was quite interesting.
I have a quick question first, which is, two questions really. One is, how were these administered? I presume that they didn't have intravenous, but it was all, what's the medical way? PO or something? by mouth?
Orally or rectally, we don't really know a lot of the fine details. I mean, the ways that they could have administered it were by eating it, by inhaling the vapor, effectively smoking it, by making a paste out of it and inserting it into a bodily orifice, or the one well-known way of using these substances was in the so-called witch's flying ointment. Now, you've heard of I'm sure of the legends of witches riding broomsticks. Well, it's thought, and I'm not sure how much truth there is in this. It's thought that medieval witches or people performing pagan ceremonies, let me put it that way, used to smear ointment on broom handles, which contained anesthetic agents. And then, if they rubbed the broom handle between their legs when they were naked, it would have been absorbed through the mucous membranes and got into the body that way. So, although witches didn't fly on broomsticks, if they took this stuff in the way described, it would probably make them feel as though they were flying.
And how did they, I might be jumping the gun here, but how did they determine dosage, and how did they regulate dosage? Because that's one of the nice things about a Vicodin pill, is you know how much you're getting.
That's right. Well, that is problematical. The trouble is with the religious persecutions of village healers and cunning folk and witches in the Middle Ages, most of that knowledge was lost. Most of the people practicing it would have been unable to write down what they were doing. They would have simply remembered it and passed it on verbally to their apprentice or other family members. So when they died, the knowledge of precisely what doses were needed and what combination of drugs were needed and how to administer them, a lot of that knowledge would have died with them. So as a result, almost nothing was known about herbal anesthetics by the early 1800s, after about 4 centuries of religious persecution. So, one of the things that I'm hoping to do is to try to rediscover correct doses and modes of administration and so on by experimentation, which I'm going to have to do very carefully.
So two things. One of them is we already did it once, but can you please do the obligatory don't try this at home statement? And then second, I gave you short shrift on medieval. You started and then I interrupted you. So can you do the medieval a little bit more after you give the obligatory statement?
Sure, yes, the obligatory warning. Don't try this at home. I'm experimenting with these herbs for genuine medical purposes, but they're not suitable for recreational use. If you want to use something recreational, go for something safer like cannabis. These can and will kill you if you don't use them carefully, and in particular, monkshood, hemlock, and deadly nightshade are all nerve agents. If you take enough of them, they will paralyze your respiratory muscles and they will kill you within 5 minutes, which is less time than it would take for someone to get you to hospital. So don't. I would hate for anyone listening to this broadcast to come to harm as a result of anything that we've discussed. So, anyway, back to medieval times. So, I mentioned earlier cunning folk, and that was a medieval term for traditional healers. Now, when t today, if we describe someone as cunning, it has overtones of being a bit sly, a bit untrustworthy, but that wasn't the meaning of the word in medieval times. What it meant then was simply wise or knowledgeable. So the cunning folk were knowledgeable about medicinal plants and how to use them for medicinal purposes. Unfortunately, the religious purges of the 13th to the 16th century resulted in a great many of them being arrested, tortured, confessions extracted, executed, property confiscated, and so on. As this went on over time, fewer and fewer of them were able to practice. So, as a result of that, by the time the Napoleonic Wars came around in the early 1800s, not only do people no longer know how to use plant-based anesthetics, but the very existence of plant-based anesthetics seem to have been forgotten. So, for example, if you were injured in the Napoleonic Wars and you had maybe a musket ball in your arm or leg and the limb couldn't be salvaged and had to be amputated, if you were a common soldier, you got a piece of wood to bite on and four strong men to hold you down, and the surgeon just did it with a saw as quickly as possible. If you were lucky and you were an officer, you got a swig of brandy and then you got the piece of wood and the four strong men, etc. It was very brutal. It was such a shame because there were these anaesthetic agents which could have made the process a lot more merciful. But anesthetics weren't rediscovered until the 1840s, when the chemical industry was expanding and people then discovered chemical anesthetics like ether and chloroform, laughing gas, nitrous oxide. And from then, the science of anesthetics advanced by leaps and bounds. So today, as you mentioned, we have intravenous anesthetics. And the drugs we use are much more refined. We know the exact doses to use. And everything is much more carefully controlled.
Let's go back to the medieval for just a moment. And what I recognize that, as you said, a lot of these people were not literate, so they didn't write down things. But, well, A, how do we even know, except for the persecution, how do we even know that they existed? And B, do we have any ideas like scope of use, like were people using it for a minor headache, or was this something that you might get once in your lifetime because you had, you know, a what's it called when the bone sticks out of the skin on a fracture?
Compound fracture.
So you have a compound fracture, something really horrible that you need it for. Was it a regular part of life, or was it unusual, and how do we know?
The details are rather scanty. We know mainly through second-hand accounts. We have very little which has been handed down to us by the practitioners themselves. But what we do know comes from confessions extracted by the church inquisitors. So if they suspected someone of being a quote witch unquote, they would ask them what plants they were using. If you said that you were growing henbane or mandrake, that was pretty much, you know, you were done. That was a death sentence. And the inquisitors would have written down what was being used. But in most cases, they didn't go further and establish the doses or exactly how they were being used, because they had no interest in that. You know, they just wanted the name of the plant for the confession and the sentence, and that was it. Other people, some writers of the time, compiled what we call leech books. The most famous one is the Leech Book of Bald. Bald was, we think, an abbot in the 9th or 10th century. And a leech book, it's a bit of a confusing name. It's not a book about leeches, but leech was, again, another old English word for medicine or cure. So people would have written down what they knew about herbal medicine in these books. But the books were very few and far between, because there was no printing in those days, of course. So all books had to be written by hand. And to have a handwritten book of any length, it would have been enormously expensive, and it would have been out of reach of anyone except the aristocracy. And of course, we're talking several hundred years ago, so even if the books existed, they probably wouldn't have survived the passage of time. So what we have really are fragments, things that have been recopied. For example, in the monasteries, that the monks would copy and recopy Greek and Roman manuscripts. Some of them had information about herbs that would have been used to render people unconscious or kill pain or cause relaxation. So that the copies of the copies of the copies have survived up until the present day. those, and it's possible, of course, that some practitioners may have been literate and may have written down what they did. I'm not aware of any of those books being in existence, but it's certainly possible that in private collections, there may be some of these books.
So, I'm going to go on a little digression here. So, my mom loved to travel. My mom died 2.5 years ago of pancreatic cancer. Anyway, she loved to travel. And one of the things she was very sad about was that she never saw the poppy fields in Afghanistan because she's seen pictures and they were so beautiful. And so, it is legal in the United States to grow opium poppies. It is not legal to, whatever the word is, to process the
Extract.
extract. So what I did is for 1 year for her birthday, I bought her a whole bunch of opium poppies and started the seeds, and then we transplanted them out to the garden. I transplanted them for her. And I live in a place where it's sort of a temperate rainforest, and so they didn't do very well. They grew, but the flowers are very small, and it wasn't nearly as exciting as I had hoped it would be. The point is, if we take you back in time 500 years and we don't put you in someplace hot like Afghanistan or Syria where opium poppies would grow, because I know opium can be used for pain. If you're exactly where you are at this moment, 500 years ago, and you are a GP or a cunning folk, or you're going to treat someone's pain, what would you have used in that climate, in that area, to treat their severe pain? Because opium won't work, right? Because it won't grow there.
I think you're a bit pessimistic about that. I live in a little windswept island not far from Scotland, and I've grown opium poppies, and they seem quite happy here.
Well, so
But it's certainly true
it's just me being a crappy gardener then.
that quite possibly. But you're certainly right. I mean, some things will grow better in some climates than others. So, for example, one thing that the Romans used a lot was mandrake, Mediterranean mandrake. Their anesthetic of choice was a combination of mandrake and opium. I cannot, for the life of me, grow Mediterranean mandrakes here, but I grow something else called white bryony, which has almost exactly the same combination of toxoids in the root that mandrake does, and it's adapted to northern climates, and it grows perfectly well. So you have to be a bit flexible. I mean, Jimson weed is another one, and that's used more for rendering someone drowsy or unconscious than for pain. That grows very well in the United States. So, for example, the reason it's called Jimson weed is that's a slang way of saying Jamestown weed. It grew in profusion around Jamestown, and some English soldiers in pre-revolution times took it and were unconscious for a week, I believe. But I'm having a lot of difficulty growing Jimson weed here. So you just have to be flexible and do what you can, and sometimes you can tweak the microclimate a bit by growing under glass or growing against a south-facing wall, things like that.
So, okay, and don't give enough details that somebody can actually do it, but I want to sort of walk through this. Let's say, first off, it's about 500 years ago. What's a battle in Scotland 500 years ago about?
So the Battle of Culloden.
Okay, so I am a soldier there and I get hit with a pike or hit with a halberd or a heavy sword or something. And my arm is in bad shape, and I come to you, or that I'm brought to you, and you're probably going to have to cut off my arm. You want to deal with my pain. So basically, what do you do? I mean, do you then like, do you would the cunning folk, would they have had like, would it have been like we see in the, oh, J.K. Rowling, the Harry
Oh,
Potter
the
series.
Harry
Would it have
Potter,
been would it have been like that, where you have where the person has like 140 different little containers that each hold powder, and then you combine them all together and make a liquid? Or I mean, how would it actually work?
Well, I don't think you'd need 140. I've identified eight plants, a surprisingly small number, but these are the plants which crop up again and again in the ancient Sumerian clay tablets and the Greek and Roman writings and the medieval confessions and so on. So you don't really need a lot of plants, you just need a few that work. So the eight that are the usual suspects are opium, mandrake, white bryony, which I've mentioned already, henbane, monk's hood, jimson weed, hemlock, and deadly nightshade. And a combination of those will really give you everything you want. You've got things, you've got the opium in there for pain, you've got some that cause unconsciousness, and some that cause paralysis. And that's really all that you need from a modern anaesthetic as well.
So they bring me to you, and then you have eight containers, presumably
Yeah.
of powdered substance or something, and then you deliver it to me, and then it's just as though you had, not just as though, but it is analogous to you having given me a shot of, whatever it is we use these days to paralyze, to relax, and to anesthetize.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if I was working in Scotland 500 years ago, I would probably use alcohol as a kind of standby because, that's available everywhere and it does a little bit of pain relief and dulling the consciousness. I would probably have burnt henbane seeds under the patient's nose because henbane grows really easily here. And the reports that have come down to us from medieval times suggest that that was how it was used. It was the seeds. And white bryony roots, the roots are enormous, they're like a turnip. So you would probably, I would think, use dried root and either combine it with pig fat and rub it on the patient's skin and hope some would be absorbed that way, perhaps insert it into the rectum. Perhaps you'd also burn it along with the henbane. But I think, using a combination of those methods, you could get enough into them that the experience of having an arm or leg amputated wouldn't be nearly as unpleasant as it would be otherwise.
I think this is extraordinary. So, and very fascinating to me. So before we move forward to, you had us in the 1840s, before we move back to the 1840s, and this may be beyond your area of interest or remit, but why did they try for 500 years or 400 years to get rid of these herbal medicines?
If you think about Middle Eastern countries today, think Afghanistan, think Syria, those countries are rife with religious intolerance and persecution and human rights violations. Well, medieval Europe was just like that 500 years ago. All of life revolved around religion. And if you were the wrong religion, or even if you were the right religion, but you just didn't do it quite right, you didn't go to church often enough, or you had the wrong sort of icons in your home or your church, then the witch finders would be on you. It was really no different than the Taliban in present-day Afghanistan. And that just went on and on and on for about 400 years, until people came to their senses in the 1700s, and that was the period that we call the Enlightenment for obvious reasons, and that immediately preceded the Industrial Revolution. But I think it was basically human psychology and religious intolerance.
So it would have been sort of the equivalent of when they were destroying all those statues and ancient so-called idols.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you've heard of the Taliban blowing up ancient monuments. Well, Henry VIII went around destroying monasteries and cathedrals. It was exactly the same thing.
Okay, let's move to the 1840s, and I know in the American Civil War that anesthetics were basically, for the most part, on the same level as you described in the Napoleonic Wars. They did have some chloroform. I know that Stonewall Jackson, when he got shot, he was put under chloroform, but they didn't have enough for most soldiers. So a lot of them, it was a piece of wood to bite on. So let's move forward. Sorry, go ahead.
Sure. Well, the American Civil War was actually, if you got injured, it's never pleasant being injured, but it was definitely more pleasant in the American Civil War than in the Napoleonic War, because they did, as you say, have chloroform. They also had morphine. Whether there was enough of it to treat mass casualties, I suspect that if there were a lot of casualties and there wasn't enough to go around, the officers probably got it, but the ordinary rank and file soldiers probably didn't. But by the First World War, there would have been enough of everything to go around.
Which sort of brings us to World War II, when there was... when in some places there were not enough to go around. Talk about the naval blockades by German U-boats, and probably the same with the blockades in Germany in World War One and Two.
Yes, that's right. Well, Britain, being an island, was very vulnerable to naval blockades. So the Germans had U-boats patrolling the seas around Britain during both World Wars, and that was a big problem for us, because we had our British Empire in those days, and we're used to importing all sorts of things, medicines and foods and textiles and things like that from all the corners of the empire. And when that suddenly stopped because of the blockade, we really had to rethink things pretty quickly and start producing a lot of things at home. And people actually forget the measures that were taken in wartime. So, for example, during World War II, farmers here were growing things like henbane and deadly nightshade and opium poppies, and children were sent out into the fields and hedgerows to collect things like rose hips for vitamins, all sorts of things like that. And people really had to know their plants very well. You know, wild foraging was very big. And I believe children got paid a few pennies for every ton of rose hips they collected, or something like that. But of course, once the war ended and the blockades were lifted, that was all consigned to the dustbin of history, and we went forward with chemical-based anesthetics and other drugs. But it's always possible that we may have to relearn those old skills and go back to that again.
So before we go to that, I have a couple more questions. One of them is, you haven't mentioned fungi. And is that because it's not your area of interest, or is that because fungi, I mean, certainly some of them are toxic. Do they not have anesthetic properties? I don't know the answer to that.
It's not really my area of special interest. I know some fungi are highly toxic, like destroying angel, for example, and they're every bit as toxic as, say, deadly nightshade. I'm not aware that any of them have anesthetic uses, but I could be wrong about that.
No, I forgot what my second... Oh, the second question was, it's perfectly okay that you haven't mentioned cannabis. And the reason I'm laughing is because I live in Northern California, which is like cannabis. I mean, it's cannabis central. You haven't mentioned cannabis. And is that because cannabis, the anesthetic qualities are lesser and less predictable than those of, say, opium? Or is there another reason that you haven't mentioned it so much? Because I know that it has been used for that purpose.
Yes. Well, cannabis has been used very widely for pain relief outside of anesthesia. I know a lot of multiple sclerosis sufferers use it. It's very problematic in this country because there's very strong public sentiment against the use of cannabis. I know it's much more accepted in North America. I know Canada, for example, has legalized it for recreational use. But here in the island where I live, if people try to order cannabis through the post and the parcel gets intercepted at the post office, you know, there are heavy fines. Now, there are moves afoot to try and change that. I think society is changing very slowly. The bias against cannabis is irrational, really, because it's no more harmful than alcohol or tobacco. But it's culturally, I mean, it's culturally no more accepted, for example, than guns. I mean, guns are accepted in America, but people would throw up their hands in horror here if you suggested that people should have firearms. But I can see that cannabis would be very useful for a lot of medicinal purposes.
And you brought up legality, and you know, I mentioned earlier that in the United States, it's legal to grow opium as long as you don't extract or process it. And what is the legality of most of the plants that you're talking about?
Opium poppies is the same here. You're allowed to grow them. You're not supposed to extract opium from them. The other ones, mandrake and henbane and jimson weed and so on, as far as I'm aware, that they fly under the radar of the authorities, that they haven't been used recreationally on a widespread basis. So because of that, the authorities really haven't taken an interest. Now, I think if lots of people started smoking henbane seeds and driving under the influence of henbane and so on, it would be different. But yes, I mean, there are virtually no legal restrictions on any of these drugs or any of these plants.
Oh, I want to mention two things about opium, or ask two things about opium. One is, I know in the United States, it was sometimes called, I think, something like shaker tea, because it was often used as a tea for headaches. And
yes,
so it was used not only for dramatic pain, but also for lesser pains. I just wanted to mention that. And then the other thing is, how do they deal with, I know my mom had a terrible, terrible general reaction to morphine, in that it would nauseate her horribly. And years ago, I put on an opium patch for something. I mean, it was all legal. I mean, it was for real. And I don't remember what the purpose was, but there was an opium patch that, or maybe it was a morphine patch, and I could only leave it on for like 15 minutes because it would really nauseate me. So how did they deal with the nausea? I'm sure that a lot of these things, these toxins also make you not feel very good. So how did they deal with when they're using opium as a primary anesthetic, how did they deal with the nausea?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's dose related, for one thing. So maybe you just have to titrate the dose carefully. But I think maybe the other thing is, if your arm is hanging off and you know, you've been shot up with musket balls, maybe being nauseous isn't the first thing on your mind, and you know, you just want to take the opium and get it over with.
Good point.
Going back to the opium tea, I suspect the practice of using opium seed heads to make tea is probably more widespread than people think. I was in a friend's garden last summer, and he was showing me around his vegetable patch, and you know, we looked at the squashes and the beans and the cauliflower, and then in the middle of his vegetable patch there was a big clump of opium poppies, which had, you know, lost the flowers, and it was, you know, just the seed pods. And my friend sort of saw me looking at them and quickly steered me in the other direction, you know, towards the peas and the carrots and things. So I didn't ask him anything about that, but I knew why those opium poppies were there among the vegetables. But you know, obviously it's not the sort of thing you want to advertise.
That's great. So, you know, you brought this up at the beginning, and I'm known in my writing for writing about how I mean, all of my writing is about how this way of living won't last, and how, you know, my work is mainly about when this way of living is over, I want for there to be as much of the natural world left as possible. But in addition, yeah. I think it's really important to, I think it's, given that there is widespread understanding that this way of living won't last, I think it is unforgivable for people not to be trying to figure out how we are going to live after. So I think that you're doing absolutely important work in starting to ask these questions now. I would rather be asking questions about how we figure out plant-based anesthetics when we still have access to synthetic ones in case our experiments don't work. And so can you talk about, I mean, so let's just talk for a moment explicitly about the importance of this work in general, and then B, some of the steps. Like, you sent me a list of things that we might talk about, which included identifying plants, growing plants, the dangers of plants, etc. So can you A, talk again about why you're doing this, and B, talk about the steps that, okay, I'm trying to be really careful with this. Talk about the steps that need to be done socially, and also the steps to be done individually, recognizing that this is dangerous and people shouldn't do it at home. But at the same time, we should learn how to identify the plants, right? I mean, so what should we and should we not do? That's what I'm trying to get at. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, that's quite a few questions rolled into one. So, so why am I doing it? I mean, this way of life that we live today is very comfortable. You know, I enjoy living in a centrally heated home with flushing toilets and hot showers and watching television every night. It can't last. It really can't, because for the last 250 years, our technological civilization has been built on the back of fossil fuels, and those are rapidly running out. People talk about a transition to renewable energy. I can't see it myself, because in order to manufacture things like electric cars and wind turbines and solar panels, you need a platform of fossil fuels in order to do it. So, for example, I drive an electric car, a Nissan Leaf. In order to make that car, tons of rock, hundreds of tons of rock would have had to be mined in order to extract the metals to make the battery and the other metal parts of the car. Hundreds of barrels of oil have been sucked out of the ground to make the plastics that went into the car. When I drive it, it uses electricity, which is generated by burning fossil fuels in the local power station. And that's just an example of the wishful thinking that pervades our society. So I can see over the next 100, maybe 200 years, people are really going to rethink the way we live in a big way. And it's very important that we start experimenting and start thinking about these things now when we don't have to, rather than waiting until a crisis comes and then doing it. So, for example, I'm learning to grow my own food, but this is a process which takes 5 or 10 years. I rented an allotment, which is a 30 by 100 foot patch of land. And I got no food off it for the first year, because I was just hopeless at it. You know, I didn't know how to weed and water and plant stuff. Now, if I was depending on that to keep me alive, I would be dead. Now, I got quite a bit of food off it the second year, and I'm actually doing pretty well the third year. But I mean, it took me 3 years to get there. And the same is true for plant-based anesthetics. I've been trying to grow Jimson weed for the last 2 years. All my plants died last year. I've got some rather small plants this year, which are surviving, and I think I know what I did wrong, and I can raise them better next year. But again, this all takes time, and you need to do it while you still have the option of going to the grocery store and, you know, coming back home with a week's worth of groceries. You know, don't, for goodness sake, leave it until there's a crisis and the shelves are empty.
And so what should, that's why. And now what should we be doing socially? And again, recognizing the dangers individually to start preparing for this. Go ahead.
I don't know that anything can be done socially as a group. I used to be active in environmental groups like Friends of the Earth. It's quite big in England. I don't know if you have that particular group in the United States, but I think non-governmental organizations like that over the last 20 years have largely been co-opted by governments. And governments and politicians are not going to pull us out of this. They just tell us what we want to hear, which is the future is rosy, the future is green, we're all going to be driving electric cars and having bases on Mars and so on. Or living in green buildings. It's all nonsense as far as I can see. So I think the only way to prepare for this is individually or at the family level, learn how to grow food, have your own homestead, just get out there and get your hands dirty and get things in the ground and just practice and learn from your mistakes. Keep a diary every year and do it slightly differently next year if it didn't work out last year. Just take part in the learning process.
And then, can you apply that specifically to plant-based anesthetics?
Yes, sure. You need a lot of gardening skill to grow wild plants. It's very important to realize that growing a wild plant like a mandrake or henbane or something like that is very different from growing seeds from the local seed merchant or garden center. So if I want to grow, for example, cabbages or beans or squash or something, I go to the store, I buy some seeds, I give them warmth and moisture and light, and in a couple of weeks they'll come up, they'll grow rapidly, and they'll give me a crop because they've been specially bred to do that. Now, growing wild plants, they've also been specially bred, but not to have characteristics that are pleasing and convenient to humans. They're bred for survival. So what that means is you have a seed, say of a Jimson wheat or henbane, and that seed will lie dormant until exactly the right conditions come along, and then it'll germinate. Now, the problem is those seeds can lie dormant for decades, and if you don't supply them with exactly the right conditions, you'll get no plants. So that means you have to try and figure out what the seed wants, and that can be difficult because those wild seeds don't come in a packet with instructions. You just have to do it by intelligent guesswork. So, for example, Jimson wheat seeds, I found they need room temperature to germinate because they're a semi-tropical plant. They're very susceptible to slugs and snails, so you have to use barriers to prevent them being eaten as soon as they show their heads above the soil surface. And they need lots of nutrient because if they don't have enough nutrient, the leaves turn white and fall off. And you really have to find out these things by trial and error. Some things grow easily. So, for example, white bryony, which is also called English mandrake, grows wild in this country because the conditions here are exactly right for it. If you're lucky, you can find it growing wild in hedgerows, so that's not really a problem. Other things like mandrakes and Jimson weed, deadly nightshade. They're much more problematic and can be very difficult to grow. It's really just a question of learning what you can from books, use the internet while you have it, and try and supply the plant with the conditions it needs.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time, and I guess I just have a couple questions. One of them would be, are there any organizations that you know of that are that are working to revivify the cunning folk wisdom and doing the work you're doing on a not personal but larger scale? Are there any groups who are working to systematize plant knowledge and to propagate it? Plant anesthetic knowledge.
The only organization that comes to mind which is doing something rather similar to what I'm doing is an organization based, I think, in Oxford in England called Ancient Biotics. And they're trying to recreate some of the remedies in one of the 1,000-year-old herbal medicine books, which I mentioned earlier, Ball's Leech Book. And they've had considerable success with that. They've tried to recreate the remedies exactly as they were written in the book, and they've compared them with current modern antibiotics, and they found that in some instances the ancient biotics work better. But they've only done it, I think, with three remedies, and it was like a one-off project. I don't think it's an ongoing project where they're trying to expand it into new remedies.
So you've already made this point several times. I have two questions left. You've already made this point several times, but can you just bring home for us one more time the why plant-based anesthetics is so important? I think it's absolutely crucial, and I love the work you're doing. Can you help us understand one more time why it's so important? And then the other question is, are there other things that you've wanted to say I haven't given you opportunity?
I think knowing about plant-based anesthetics is important because we have to have a plan B. At the moment, all we have is plan A, which is industrial civilization will carry on forever. I don't think that's going to happen, and at some point, we're going to have a plan B, and people should prepare as best they can for that. As far as anything else goes, I don't think so. You mentioned my blog at the beginning, which is toxicplantsblog.blogspot. I've got that right. Yes, anyway, what have you said at the beginning? My toxic plant.
Toxicplantsblog.blogspot.com.
That's it, yes. So if anyone wants to find out more about what I'm doing, I post quarterly updates. I don't have time to do it more often than that, but I post with the four seasons in March, June, September, and December. So just drop in there sometime and take a look.
Well, thank you so much for all your work here, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Peter. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.